Hello, and welcome to Threadings. Thank you so much for being here. It's been a second. I am, at the moment, very, very warm. I have an essay for you that I've written in many middle of the nights. I am at home in Sierra Leone. I feel peace about that, despite me again being very, very warm. This essay was almost entitled The Orange Trees Teach Me Art Making for reasons that will be obvious toward the end, but I settled on the title, The Role of the Artist is to Load the Gun, in attempts to answer the question, what's the role of the artist today in this current moment? But I'm ahead of myself. Introductions. I write to you from a moment in 2024 where the sounds of the machine, business as usual, keep me up at night. Those are words of Ivy_with_art on Instagram. This loop of time, existing at once as a result of previous realities and made new in outward iteration, contains human desires that are materialized into these cascading moments of beauty juxtaposed up against heinous war and death-making. And I am here, still in it, still breathing, an artist with goals of freedom. I am here to discuss what I owe to myself and what I owe to the people who make and remake me. Of course, we have to define terms before we go anywhere. What is art? While I personally think art is best defined by its effect rather than its mere existence, I submit a collected definitions across a few dictionaries to find some more tangible ideas. Art, noun. The conscious use of the imagination in the production of objects intended to be contemplated or appreciated as beautiful, as in the arrangement of forms, sounds, or words. Art is skill that is attained by study, practice, or observation. Art is human effort to imitate, supplement, alter, or counteract the work of nature. Art is a recreation of reality according to the artist's metaphysical value judgments. Here's claim one. Art making, A, is world making, B, is truth telling. C, A equals B equals C. Art making is world making is truth telling. In the next handful of time, I am to convince you of the following theses. Art making is world making, A equals B, as seen in the above definition, the recreation of reality, the human effort to alter or counteract nature. Art making is divine in its ability to make and shape and reshape what we come to understand as real, relevant, and true. That's A equals C. Art making is truth telling. Truth, the ability to shape it and market it and to have others strengthen it with their own belief, carves out reality. Truth carves out reality. And reality is just what we collectively agree upon. Multiple realities can exist at once, even from person to person. Truth, just like any other weapon, can act as an agent of oppression or as a means of liberation, depending on who it is crafting the narrative. Art making has the capacity to be revolutionary, which solidifies people, which archives them, which galvanizes them to wander into greater freedoms, even if, or perhaps especially within their own imagination, art making A shapes culture, C where culture is a collection of truths and beliefs bound together by collected and repeated actions. A equals C. Art shapes culture, where culture is a collection of truths and beliefs bound together by collected and repeated actions, meaning it is one of the most powerful tools available to everyone who endeavors to create. All creation pushes back on the world, which pushes back on us. A equals B equals C. The primary inquiries. What is the function of art within a capitalist society? What is the function of art in societies that propel past capitalism into new sprouts of freedom? We also must introduce a teacher who guides my work as a whole and this particular working inquiry, Toni Cade Bambara, TCB, sometimes abbreviated, pictured above holding one of her students who wrote this lovely piece about her. It's hyperlinked in the newsletter. Go ahead and get your juice. Maybe best known in contemporary culture for the maxim pictured with her above. As a culture worker who belongs to an oppressed people, my job is to make revolution irresistible. Filmmaker, writer, community member Tony K. Bambara gave life to the dance of the artist as the desire to create, springing from her actions towards communal liberation. This short piece by her granddaughter, also linked in the newsletter, it was lovely. Her dedication to being in the field, mouth don't win the war, has guided me in my pursuits of creative life, as do these moments she gave in an interview she did in 1982 with Kay Benetti. The question, what determines your responsibility to yourself and your audience? These are Toni Cade Bambara's words. I start with the recognition that we are at war, and war is not simply a hot debate between the capitalist camp and the socialist camp on which economic, political, social arrangement will have hegemony in the world. It's not just the battle over turf and who has the right to utilize resources for whomever's benefit. The war is also being fought over the truth. What is the truth about human nature, about human potential? My responsibility to myself, my neighbors, my family, and the human family is to try and tell the truth, and that ain't easy. There are so few truth-speaking traditions in this society in which the myth of Western civilization has claimed the allegiance of so many. We have rarely been encouraged and equipped to appreciate the fact that the truth works. The truth works, that it releases the spirit, and that it is a joyous thing. That's Toni Cade Bambara, 1983, interviewed by Claudia Tate, answering the question, what determines your responsibility to yourself and your audience? All bolding was my own. This passage, along with the maxim first quoted in that 1982 moment, right? My job is to make revolution irresistible. These guide us through this essay, which stitches the following theses together into a quilt that keeps me warm at night. One. One of the greatest powers held in the human sovereign world is the power to create and destroy, to make, shape, and reshape the world and what we know to be true. I call this world making. Two, we are currently at war and, I would argue, in the exposition of a new world. Three, this world is still actively being made. What constitutes power in the hands of the masses? What methods of world making are truly available to us? Let's begin. The madness of opulence. Opulence, noun. From Century Dictionary, opulence, wealth, riches, affluence, all these words imply not only the possession of much property, but the possession of it under such circumstances that it can be and is enjoyed. They seem contrasted not only with their opposites, but in possession of a moderate amount. Contrasted with the possession of even just a moderate amount. Opulence is dignified, and it's a strong word for wealth. Wealth and riches may mean the property possessed, and riches does generally mean that, others do not. Affluence suggests the flow of wealth to one, the flow of a lot of wealth to one person, and resulting free expenditure for objects of desire, read the ability to buy whatever the hell you please, whenever the hell you please. The text, How to Go Mad Without Losing Your Mind, embraces madness from the focal point of reason, capital R reason, an ideological framework codified into habits, thoughts, performances, and acceptable experiences felt and exercised by normal, in quotes, society. For a more in-depth understanding, check this essay. Again, linked in the newsletter, whatever makes reasonable, capital R, thought and action within white supremacist world making often moves in tandem step with what's best for those same world makers. Endless expansion and endless consumption, necessarily resulting in lives of varying degrees of hell for those that deviate from the ideals of white patriarchal capitalism. This is constant exposure to premature death. We're going to run this back because that was a lot to listen to. So what makes reasonable thought, as in capital R, reasonable thought and action within white supremacist world making, what makes you reasonable, what makes you just, what makes you sane, is often moving in tandem step in twin time with what's best for those same white supremacist world makers. Endless expansion and endless consumption, necessarily resulting in lives of varying degrees of hell for those that deviate from the ideals of white patriarchal capitalism. Deviating means that you are constantly exposed to premature death. There are multiple apparatuses of violence that you have to navigate when you deviate from what white world makers deem as sane. I find value, personally, in gazing at the world from my own lived and learned points of view as if I am the world maker. As if everything gleams in black, indigenous, poor, and working class, third world, disabled, sex working glory. While I do not take stock in the idea of hierarchical truth, I ask different questions when I consider myself the authority on what constitutes sanity and rationality, such as, what sort of insanity drives a white genocidal maniac to become such a thing? How did y'all get like that? Why thrust all the creative and inventive power that you have into advancing the technologies of death? Why burn holes in the human tapestry for systems that you made up? What fuels the desire to act out of the best interest of the whole species, including, eventually, the interests of yourself and your children? Do we ever stop to consider how buck wild that trait is? What drives a human to invent and to seek capital where otherwise we've seen land, trees, seas, and the beauty of being? Enter the madness of opulence. Previous to the strip club, I was never compelled by the art or the music of opulence. We have come to the portion of the essay where I remind you, reader, listener, learner, that the pen who forms these studies is not invisible nor objective insofar as one objective viewpoint actually exists. My name is Ismatu. I am a poet trying to convince you of something. I have, allegedly, for the purposes of storytelling, done a great many drugs. I have never, ever encountered a high like money, not ever. I do try and keep my recent history with sex work as common knowledge as possible, especially because this history in sex work shaped so much of my understanding of United States policy. Yet, I still find myself perpetually, in quotes, coming out with this identity, so in case you're new or not that studied in my online life, I decided to become a stripper after several months of research and growing economic desperation. It was very church girl shakes asked to afford graduate school city living sitcom-esque exposition, okay? Very boring, a couple years of my life. Growing up, one, impoverished, and two, of West African parentage, I was not particularly invested in hip-hop as a genre or as a culture until I began dancing. The first time I ever entered into a strip club was also my first night working in one. All of my previous hesitations about this sort of music, obsessions with money and status and drugs and hoes and the ways that those were synonymous, dissolved in a wash of mixed bills raining from the sky. The music of opulence never made more sense in my body, in my physical body, than when I was spinning from my ankles, arms out to either side of me, far from sober, flying through clouds of paper, power, floating leisurely, as if the money itself was happy to see me. Currency in this society, cash, social capital, stock portfolios and assets, property, business accrual and acumen, all of these things, currency, function as a token for you to trade for power. Currency in this society function as a token to trade for power. The ability and the potential to make the world in your image, or at least your world in your image. Thus, under capitalism, the brilliance of world making synthesizes in blue banded hundreds. Drugs are here to make you feel comfortable, or euphoric, or powerful. Recall the claim at the top of this essay. One of the greatest powers held in the human sovereign world is the power to create and destroy, to make and shape and reshape the world in what we know to be true. I call this world making. The Anthropocene under capitalism reduces the means of world making down to the acquisition of currency, which is just a token for power. I postulate that high concentrations of world making power disembodied from love or compassion for the human condition truly does make one insane enough to want to harm the most vulnerable to maintain the high you get. These tokens of power act as a drug that you never want to come down from, especially because on the come down, you risk coming into contact with the waste produced from your consumption, from the lives that you lay waste to. Money, just like other drugs, requires you to get more and more just to maintain your distance from the ground. I place my personal experiences alongside my larger inquiries to help flesh out the facets of me that you all have come to know. I, the pen behind this essay, Ismatu, don't forget that I am a person trying to convince you of something. I was radicalized into compassion by the communities that I belong to. The feedback I get of myself on the internet is mostly saintly, honestly, so I need you all to understand I was so very close to committing to black capitalism. I was so close. Had I been a stripper that felt more belonging to tricks in the club than my coworkers, we likely would have never crossed paths in this internet space. I would not be here doing this. I would be living a gilded life as a well-educated housewife, okay? The epitome of black luxury. My mother would be elated. I would be engaged in a cacophony of low to high exclusivity substances and experiences to make sure the part of me that had awoken to desires for freedom, for true freedom, stayed sleeping, stayed asleep. Opulence, the fragrance that blooms off the wealthy, not just having a lot, but having far, far more than most, having what it takes to have an insatiable appetite, acts like a drug. Opulence acts like a drug. It drives you nuts. In this iteration of world making, a life of luxury denotes the ability to consume endlessly and produce endless waste without consequence or delay. The intoxication of power lulls you into forgetting your place on the human tapestry, not as the king nor as the soul weaver, but as one stitch among billions. That's the thing about drugs. They numb the pain. They fill you with a false sense of power and euphoria. The opulence gets you so high that you look down on anyone not managing to soar to your level. They must not want it like you want it. They must want to be down there, broke, starving. It's all a mindset anyways. They must not quite deserve it like you deserve it. Take another hit. Take another hit. The wealthy find new ways to bloom. They take another hit, another party, another award show, another private yacht, jet, island, and we, the masses, left down here to rot amongst their ruins, wanting so desperately to escape the hellscapes made for us, gaze upward and long to be up there, glittering with far better drugs. World-making shapes truth. The art that comes from the elite triggers disassociation by design. And art making is world making. The power they wield cannot spring spontaneously from thin air. Just like energy, I argue that power cannot be created nor destroyed, only transferred. Our ruling class benefits from us considering this world bereft beyond saving because it keeps us looking up, gazing at them, longing for escape, which in turn keeps them powerful enough to continue floating up there, aspirational, away from the worlds that they destroy in the wakes of their creations. Your attention is deeply lucrative. Your attention is lucrative. Clock the positive feedback loop here, right? They continue to create a world that blooms endlessly for them, while we stand mystified, tricked into understanding the power of world making exclusively as capital, as tokens. In such a world, the only way to escape the horrors of capitalism is to cause them to happen to somebody else. Music and visuals and dance and literature, all sorts of art, become escapists as a means of reinforcing the status quo and, in fact, mimic the drugged life of opulence they, our most endowed world makers, indulge in. Art making is a display and an execution of power. It is not just about telling the truth or a truth. It's about shaping truth itself. Art making is truth telling, A equals C. Here I have a screenshot from my actual Twitter feed from December 16th, 2023. Yara Eid, a Palestinian who has been a seminal voice, tweets about how she hasn't heard her mom's voice in over a day. This hits me especially hard in a season of life where my mom has cancer. She says she feels paralyzed. She says she's used to calling her every day. I know she's alive, but whoever knows me knows how attached I am to my mother. The psychological torture is another level. Every time they cut all internet and then there's an ellipsis that says show more. This tweet has 8.5 thousand likes, allegedly has 215 thousand views. And it is juxtaposed, I mean literally right above, a tweet with Flo Milli dropping the music video to Never Lose Me, which is a song about opulence. The music video in and of itself, it portrays a Houston strip club. There's money everywhere, dancing and naked women, in lyrics about how Flo Milli is desirable in a relationship with a wealthy man and how they're having a really good time. Social media is my favorite truth-shaping, world-making drug. I've written about this before, how life in imperial cores like the United States, where I was born, necessitates that we have drugs of comfort and numbness everywhere to disassociate from what we cause. It's an essay entitled Drugs Are Fucking Everywhere and We're All Addicted to Comfort. It's very good. I would recommend you listen to it. It's on the Substack. As easy as it is to focus on the 1% that holds the majority of the world's wealth, my countrymen in Sierra Leone continue to spend their lives gazing up at what they imagine the U.S. to be like at any level of living. I grew up in poverty there, in various states in the U.S. Yes, there are those glittering above me, but that's not to say I too do not float above the decay of the colonized world, or that I haven't managed to figure out how to do that over time. By the time I was a teenager, I wasn't eating Kraft Singles for dinner anymore. I was navigating food insecurity in a relatively stable home in the suburbs. That came with its own set of challenges, of course, but that is stratospheres. But that is stratospheres above food insecurity in a rural part of Sierra Leone. Being personally poor is very different than not having the infrastructure to move at all. Socials have changed our methods, our lenses, our understandings of the world around us, which in turn reshapes the world. We can see very clearly with the ongoing genocide in Gaza, right? Which would have gone completely unchecked if Palestinians weren't able to live stream their own deaths to the connected world, crowdsource funds to evacuate, and call for action. Iraqis, for example, had no such media to commandeer in 2003 when the United States fabricated the war on terror and they were slaughtered for years. 500,000 estimated dead by the will of the empire, and that is most likely an undercount. We're still finding mass graves. We did that for oil. Remember, no tool that we have a widespread access to exists without the consent of the empire. I don't care how radical it feels. If they allow it to exist, it's because they've made carefully calculated risk assessments. In the same way social media works to reshape reality, the widespread circulation of graphic scenes and rising death tolls work to numb you to the atrocities of life. It's the same eerie feeling I witnessed during the explosion of Black Lives Matter uprisings across the world. More visibility does not always equal more sustained action. Jasmine on TikTok said it really well. When we take shrooms, when we experience an emotional peak, this is a video I'm quoting of hers, but you can watch it on the newsletter. You go from here to here to here to here, up, down, up, down. When you smoke weed, depending on the strain, either you experience a burst of creativity, you experience some sort of euphoric sedation, or you experience a heightened state of paranoia and anxiety. When you watch TikTok first thing in the morning, you might watch a video of a baby laughing, and then next is a white cop playing basketball with black kids in the middle of the street, and then next video is a white cop holding a black man at gunpoint for a simple traffic stop. And then the next video is TikTok shop trying to sell you the spin brush. You're going to see content that takes you up, down, up, down, up, here, 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 here. When you watch the news, what do? They give you heavy content, light content, heavy content, light content, because if they only give you one or the other, you won't watch it, you won't engage. The threat here is that the ways that we have to ingest stories all act like drugs. Art making is world making. The art making of marketability and riding waves of virality across the world. The art of journalism and video sharing. The art of connection across timelines and oceans. Poets and illustrators and photographers sharing pieces that stick on me so intimately they move the flesh and bone out of the way to imprint my heart. Those things coexist next to the wills of the empire. We have social media because the world makers in charge, again, white genocidal warmongering maniacs, can at least attempt to degrade our sense of horror and urgency with shock value and overexposure. It normalizes something that was once unthinkable, seeing the same scenes of subjugation over and over again. When I had a Facebook in 2012, images of nudity and violence never, ever would have proliferated like this. We must never fail to ask why. What important truths are being formed here? Let's return to Toni Kade Bambara's My Job is to Make Revolution Irresistible. Lesser known is the morsel she said just before defining her job as one artist belonging to an oppressed people in an answer to the question, what is the task of the artist? Again, 1982, okay? The task of the artist is determined always by the status and process and agenda of the community that it already serves. I'm gonna run that back. The task of the artist is determined always by the status and process and agenda of the community that it already serves. If you are an artist who identifies with, who springs from, who is served by or drafted by a bourgeoisie class, then that's the kind of writing you do. Your job is to maintain a status quo, to celebrate exploitation or guise it in some lovely romantic way. That's your job. Then and only then does she follow with the famous maxim, my role as a culture worker belonging to oppressed people is to make revolution irresistible. But that is not certainly every artist's job. There are a good many powerful, world-making artists that maintain a status quo, that romanticize exploitation. They play on the radio and star in feature films year after year after year. I just updated my thoughts about Beyoncé and went viral again for dissenting to the airs of working class solidarity she dons when it's time to circulate her wildly lucrative art. While she certainly is not the only example, it does pain me particularly that the reigning monarch of the music industry chooses liberation in her works and capitalist oppression in her business decisions. As previously stated, money is a blank check for world making. There are many ways to make and shape the world outside of money. Art making is one particularly powerful tool as it allows us to expand or confine our imaginations to what is possible. In consuming art, the feasible solidifies. In consuming art, the feasible solidifies. The dreamscape takes shape. It registers feeling in our bodies. Art reflects back to us the lens of the artist, what they yearn for, what they know to be true, and shapes our worldview accordingly. Art making is world making. A equals B. The two are not just synonymous, they are the same. We in the working classes, the survival classes, often think art making is only for the rich or those with leisure time, that it's unrealistic, that art is a luxury compelling us to disengage with our material tasks, and also that disengaging from our material tasks is a bad thing. Who benefits from those beliefs? What if we were to make or engage with art that compels us towards our circumstance? What happens when art exalts the common thread? When art takes our upward gaze and turns it towards one another? We crave truths that feel usable to us. I saw a video commenting on how fracturing it is to navigate a reality that does not reflect the times with the art, stating they was not singing about brown booties and coochies when we was protesting in the streets. These sentiments were stitched by a creator I love at Horatia's mansion, saying, actually, escapism really does reflect the time. From the video, I don't think that this is at all true. And just because we don't think that it doesn't reflect the part of the times that it should, doesn't mean it's not reflecting any of them. If you just scroll TikTok at any given time in any algorithm, you will see very quickly that there are many people who are intentionally, blissfully unaware of, you know, the more serious things going on in the world. And I think that music 100% reflects that as it is currently in the mainstream. That's Horatia Grace, February of 2024. Celebrity requires aspiration to maintain the hierarchy and enough relatability such that we see themselves in us. And we don't wish to seize back the power that they siphon. This often results in artistic powerhouses dressing their works in bite-sized pieces of revolution, which to me is insidious. That is absolutely nasty work. The art does absolutely reflect the times. It tells the truth most beneficial for those in charge of current world-making. I think what we're craving is usable truths for us, a lovely understanding of art, further expanded upon by Toni Kade Bambara. This is her in 1983. I want to lift up some usable truths. I want to lift up some usable truths, like the fact that the simple act of cornrowing one's hair is radical in a society that defines beauty as blonde tresses blowing in the wind, that staying centered in the best of one's own cultural tradition is hip, is sane, is perfectly fine, despite all the claims to universality through Anglo-Saxonalizing. Is perfectly fine despite all claims to universality through Anglo-Saxonizing and other madnesses. We know the truth of how much we need a world that belongs to the masses again, rather than be domesticated pets inside of our own cubicles, mules of the ruling class. We plow their fields and we run their generators, and we are desperate for heroes, so much so that we lift up those making themselves enemies of us because they give us just enough truth within their art to feel something. Truth makes us feel something, and it is so difficult to feel anything when you are drugged out all the time. Most of the art around us builds a world that detaches us from our usable truths. At least, the art of the Western world does. What of the art that liberates? Here, pictured in the newsletter, has to be one of the most beautiful pictures I've seen in the last decade. This was April 6, 2019 in Sudan, when hundreds of thousands marched to the military headquarters and began a sit-in that led to a successful popular revolution. There are many people, hundreds, thousands, with flags in a common square. At the center, there's a bus overflowing, right? People hanging from the sides, people sitting on the front, people standing on top, waving flags for a free Sudan. The scene looks jubilant, vivacious, and colorful. Look at what alt text does. I think I need to start reading alt text more in the podcast. Remember what I began with, right? I start with the recognition that we are at war. I start with the recognition that we are at war. If art making is world making and world making is essential to liberation, what is the world that we would rather be living in? How do we then march toward that instead of away from something all the time? In the United States, the war is being fought through information. It is not profitable for the core of the empire, the supposed envy of the world, to have bullets raining down on the civilians all of the time. So they subdue us through the truths that they tell and the truths that they allow to be told. They make war on us via their policies. Remember, poverty is a policy choice, not an inevitable circumstance of humanity. And as a whole, this war is one that hides itself in plain sight. Our attention spans are shortened so that we are blanked with atrocities followed by puppies to keep even our means of information sharing as a drug. Sudan has had a really recent, thrilling history of overt war in that the people won their popular revolution in 2019. They won. That is actually the backdrop for the current war of attrition going on right now, where two military groups kill each other with as many civilian casualties and atrocities as possible so that the civilian population is easier to control when one of these groups gained power. Pause. There's a linked article here, again, in the newsletter by a friend of mine called Yasmin and her compatriot Allah. It is superb. It's the best breakdown of the current war I have read synthesized to date. Please read it. Please read it. In Sudan's popular uprising, the artist is in the unique position of truth-telling. From the photography ingenuity hallmarked by Rashid Mahdi and the current renaissance of art aided by the internet, I've linked some beautiful art up here from a young artist called Yusuf, where there are many people curved across the right half of the picture making a semicircle, drawn with the implication of a much larger crowd, and there's this beautiful little girl in a prinkfully dress launching herself through the air to get into a minibus that is like also falling out of frame. Just absolutely stunning, right? There's photography of the Renaissance, there's current art, it's all aided by how much it resonates with the people rather than the will of the dictators. Art that reflected Sudan back to herself helped lead her to her own freedom. This is also studied in an excellent, excellent article by Bedour Allegra, Sudanese professor and wayward political theorist, about the pendulum swing of Black liberation, which looked at 2019 successes in Sudan. There's a rather long excerpt right here. I'm going to read it all, but I recommend that you read these articles as well. One thing This is Dr. Allegra. One thing that I wrote in last year's piece was that the uprisings in Sudan led to an explosion of public art. All movements, big and small, are accompanied and sustained by expressive and artistic mediums, which are the most significant ways that we transmit and tell different stories about who we are as Black people, as Sylvia Winter reminds us. The pendulum swing towards repression, and the weight that swings it back cannot be credited to national parties or revolutionary armies. It comes from music, poetry, dance, what Woods referred to as cultural productions of Black working class organic intellectuals. Take, for example, Eduardo Madlin, founder of Frelimo, F-R-E-L-I-M-O, Frelimo? Frelimo, which sustained a 10-year war of independence against the Portuguese colonialism in Mozambique. In his book, The Struggle for Mozambique, he argues that the earliest signs of resistance were not the factories or in the barracks, but found in the traditional songs of the Chope people of southern Mozambique. He argues further that revolutionary and national consciousness was first sown in the traditions of the Chope, including folk songs and poetry, followed by intellectuals, artists, painters, undoing the attachments to vanguard that has long since dominated Marxian thinking. The final stage, not the first, of political consciousness was that of industrial workers and political organization. While Fanon argued in Wretched of the Earth that violence is the first act of decolonial melodrama, the activator, Monlane argued that culture loads the gun, and armed struggle pulls the trigger. Revolution is, directly translated, about returns. Culture, blues, poetry, storytelling offers, as Suzanne Césaire wrote, a return to ourselves. The pendulum swings away from liberation, and we must swing it back. Art making, not a leisure activity, not solely or simply an expression of self, but the most important medium that we have to communicate stories about ourselves as Black people, as oppressed people. Art making which hides the seeds of how to be human, art making which hides the seeds in how to be a human stitch in the tapestry again, passed for safekeeping in the hands of our indigenous. Art making as a means of mobilizing the weapon. If armed struggle is the first action of finding a world beyond colonization, beyond what we can see, culture loads the gun. The role of the revolutionary artist is to load the gun. The role of the revolutionary artist is to load the gun. What are our usable truths? The truths that we might use to swing the pendulum back, the truths which orient us to believe in our agency more than we believe in the inevitability of suffering death. Why do we believe that it is okay for art to sell us the narrative of gods among men? Why do we think that we cannot ask or expect anything of our culture makers? Why are we convinced we have to suffer? What are we fighting for? And what do we dream of? This is where I get into art like the orange trees. The orange trees teach me about art making. These are conclusions loosely entitled The Divinity of Creation, Where Divinity is Freedom. This essay did not come to me until I asked my elders for help. It's been sitting in my soul, stuck in my gut for months. I'm far from New York, and my mother moves through cancer with my father at her side, so I petition the orange trees in my parents' backyard. How do you make art? They said, to my best understanding, seamless art passes seeds beautifully. Seamless art passes seeds beautifully. Curated creation, which slides in and out of our mental spheres, more powerful and more porous, we want to believe. And that's true for both mind and art. The bloom, the fruit, the harvest, the allotment of trust. When my buds and flesh pass through you, intimate, right? The feeling of loss of something no longer being expressly mine. The great relief, the reverence, the pride at watching my seeds grow outside of me. Savor this moment we share in time space. Taste these words with me. Tell me they're not pressed up against your skin. I eat an orange and consider. This is me again. There is no way to consume the art of the orange tree without it, however temporarily, becoming a part of me. So here are some conclusions. The orange trees in my family's hard sun bloom with no sense of ownership over their art form, no sense of obligation to our faculties nor our property lines. Collectively, they shift the air of entire streets. The air becomes weightier and cooler, laden with orange blossom. Evidence, in and of itself, of the world they build with their art, the bees and bliss, their weighty fruits change things. Dead and decaying fruit dissolve into the earth in peace. We could live in a world where we do not fear death. We could live in a world where death, no longer weaponized against us, makes the ground fertile for life again. In this world's cruelty, in all the creative force we produce contributing to the war machines, we have forgotten that death is sweet. Freedom, red divinity, while world-making and sovereignty is not to make oneself a god among men, but to see, allow, and uphold divinity in each and every man. Creation is an extension of divine. Where divinity is freedom, I was made in the image of God, so I seek to be free with everything. And what do we owe one another? The art that we often create and eat in the Anthropocene tries and fails to emulate the fruit tree. All world making is an act of divinity, made in the breath of the Creator's sigh, such that we too are able to create. As far as the flower knows, the whole world is leaves and bees and the life tree. As far as the flower knows, the whole world is leaves and bees and the life tree. Every act of creation is world-making. Such is love, the purest pleasure of unmitigated life. I ask her, the tree, her motivation. She beams a child from the sky, an orange, ripe, heavy, thunks at my feet. Every sun has a becoming. The day the warplanes are quiet, I will bloom art like the orange trees, benevolent and sweet. What of today? What do I, Ismatu, an artist, a sun becoming, owe this world that I am stitched into? I am an artist belonging to oppressed peoples, among them the Rule, the Sierra Leonean, and the disabled, and that's just to name a few. I give my first fruits over to my beloveds. I present to you a project I have been working on with Social Income for over a calendar year now, as in a Gregorian calendar year. And honestly, this is the work that has propelled me since I was 19 years old. I'll be 26 this year. This is a $200,000 campaign, which will produce 3 years of basic income for all 156 Ebola survivors registered by the Sierra Leone Association of Ebola Survivors in Kenema, which is far from the capital city. I believe we might need a quick reintroduction to the author of this essay. It's been a second since I laid out my history properly. My name is Ismatu. I will see a free and fed Sierra Leone in my lifetime. I consider it my responsibility to use my education, a bachelor's degree in creative writing and global health studies, and a master's in clinical social work with a concentration in health administration and policy, in service to my communities, my rural, my indigenous, my diasporatic, my disabled, stigmatized communities across the Black U.S. America and in Sierra Leone. I first began my research on Ebola in Sierra Leone 6 years ago. I was 19. I was deeply optimistic about our future. I heard things that changed the core of myself from these people. I am now 25, and I'm a tinge more studied, and I've been radicalized into bypassing academia and sharing my findings directly with the public. I believe the Sierra Leone Association of Ebola Survivors, SLAES, has many lessons in their organizing for their continued livelihoods, especially for those of us in the North and in the West still battling COVID-19 as an invisibilized killer. Alongside other initiatives, I am campaigning for $200,000 to pilot a universal basic income program for the entire chapter of Kenema survivors, the first such program in Sierra Leone's history. For this, I'm tearing up. For this, I am proud to partner with Social Income, a non-governmental organization based in Switzerland that runs entirely on a volunteer basis and enacts a no-fees policy, meaning that every single penny anyone donates will end up in the hands of a Sierra Leonean Ebola survivor. Thank you, God. This is our second big project of the Revolutionary Healer series, which I aim to become. Over the next month or so, to raise awareness and dollars and mobilization, I explore the following theses consistent with the findings of my research. In no particular order, poverty is both a policy choice and is always the backdrop for war. Unchecked spread of disease leaves infrastructure prone to collapse. Stigma is the enemy of progress. And stigma comes from believing that other humans are not and cannot be like you. There is no exceptionalism across the Anthropocene. There is no exceptionalism across the Anthropocene. If it is happening to them, it has already happened or is already happening to you. This is especially the case with disability. You are either disabled today or disabled tomorrow. There are a great many tactics of war, making it more common than we thought. War is more common than we would like to think, particularly for those of us in the United States and in other Western strongholds who navigate a war in plain sight. Grief and memorialization is necessary for a populace to mobilize for their best world. And a world that belongs to us hinges on how quickly we can come to believe, in mass, that we can and we should care for one another. This is my first iteration of Life's Work Blooming for You. For the good of my most beloved communities, I am so elated to be alive to see this day. Thank you, God. Thank you, God. I hope the work of your day plants hope for your blooms tomorrow. Or simpler said, peace. Isma Tsuji.